Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors and your moderator for today's program. This program is being held in association with the club's Science and Technology member-led forum. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, a former NASA astronaut and CEO of the B612 Foundation, whose mission is to build, launch, and operate a deep space telescope to detect asteroids that may be a threat to Earth. Tonight's speaker is an explorer who loves mapping the unknown, whether it is the oceans at Liquid Robotics, leading Google Advanced Project teams, or unveiling the secrets of the inner solar system and saving the world with the B612 Foundation, which he co-founded and serves as chairman and CEO. A NASA astronaut for 12 years, he has flown three missions, logging 206 days in space, flew the space shuttle twice. His third mission was with the Russian Soyuz. He flew on space shuttle missions STS-84 in 1997 as a mission specialist aboard Space Shuttle Atlantis to the Russian Mir space station. He flew as payload commander and lead spacewalker on Space Shuttle Atlantis on shuttle mission STS-106 to the International Space Station in 2000, in which he carried out a six-hour spacewalk to perform construction work on the International Space Station. Having been flight engineer on Soyuz TMA-2 just 9 weeks after the loss of Space Shuttle Columbia, he spent 6 months in space in 2003 as part of the ISS Expedition 7 with cosmonaut Yuri Melnichenko. A graduate of Cornell, he earned a PhD from Stanford and has numerous commendations, including NASA's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Medal. Our speaker has served as a scientific advisor to the White House and NASA on space technology and policy issues. He retired from NASA in 2007, where he then proceeded to work for Google. In 2011, he left Google and joined Liquid Robotics as Chief of Innovative Applications. It is my honor and pleasure to introduce you tonight to our speaker, Dr. Ed Liu. Please join me in giving a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to him.
Thanks, Skip. It's a real honor to be here tonight. What I wanted to tell you is how I ended up here. It's been a long and crazy path, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about, you know, sort of my motivations for doing what I'm doing and why I think it's so important, and hopefully you'll find it important too. So what I'm showing you right now is the typical view outside the space station. Now, this is something I used to love to do. On board the space station, we had a set of image-stabilized binoculars, which, big, giant, long things, that if you press the button, they stabilize right out. And I used to love to watch the moon through them. And the reason I really liked it is because I used to like to watch the craters on the moon. And I particularly liked the view. I used to actually set my watch to give me a 30-second heads up when the moon was going to be rising as we were coming over the limb of the Earth. And knowing where it was, you could try and catch a picture of it as it came up. And it always got you thinking, because when you're looking at the moon like this and you're looking at the Earth, and what do you see on the moon? Craters. Lots of them, right? And what you realize is that those very same craters, those asteroids that created those craters by hitting the moon, those things hit the Earth. In fact, more of them hit the Earth than hit the moon because the Earth is bigger. And you just don't see the market evidence of it here because the atmosphere stops the very small ones, not the very big ones. And we have oceans, and we have weather, and we have erosion and jungles and things like that, and it covers up most of them. But fact of the matter is the Earth is hit more often than the moon. So one of the things which really sort of changed my way of thinking or sort of shaped my way of thinking, one of my experiences at NASA was actually on my very first flight. We were on board the shuttle Atlantis. We were flying it upside down, as we always do, towards the end of the mission. And so we were just one day from landing. And that meant we didn't really have that much to do. We had cleaned up, all the experiments were stowed away, and we were just getting ready to land. And we actually had a little bit of downtime. And myself and my crewmate, a guy named Jean-François Clairvoy, a French astronaut who had the nickname of Billy Bob, long story, but Billy Bob said, let's spend the day sitting on the ceiling. Let's be up, and let's sit on the ceiling, which if the ceiling is pointed towards the Earth, it felt like you're in a glass-bottom boat. So we were sort of cruising around the Earth with the windows below us looking down at the Earth as we were eating our dehydrated spaghetti. And Jean-François said, if you really think about it, humans can do some really amazing things if we work together. I mean, considering the fact that we're in a, we're flying around at 18,000 miles an hour in a human-built spaceship. And that really never left me. You sense it, but you somehow that the view of the Earth below you sort of really brings that home. And then I said, but on the other hand, when you really look at how big all this is, you realize how small we are. That, we're really, the Earth is part of something larger. There is things that are bigger than necessarily what's in front of you. Because 2 days from now, we're going to be down on the ground paying our water bill, right? And, filling out a, mowing your lawn, right? But there are bigger things, and the Earth itself is part of something bigger. And many years later, when I ended up on the space station for many months, I always used to think back to that conversation and thinking about how, in fact, what is the most important thing out there for any one person? It's what you can do that I think that makes the biggest contribution. And, I never felt like I was happier than when I was working on a big project of something bigger than yourselves. And the thing that struck you again, when getting back to looking at the moon is, at some level, somebody somewhere needs to think about the issue of the fact that these asteroids hit the Earth. And so I'm going to take a little poll here before I show this. Who here thinks asteroid impacts on Earth are rare? Wow. Just a few people. Okay, well, maybe you're far more educated than me. Let me tell you about a network of sensors that we have deployed around the world. They are sensors looking down at the Earth from above for very high temperatures. And a series of very large listening stations, they're listening for low-frequency rumbles, called infrasound, that are spread out around the Earth. Anybody have any guesses of what this is for? Nuclear weapons tests. We monitor for rocket launches and nuclear weapons explosions, okay, for obvious reasons. With this, and it turns out that a very large explosion, like a nuclear blast going off, can actually be heard from thousands of miles away, or tens of thousands of miles away. So if you have sensors all over the place and you hear it from different spots, you can actually tell where it was and how big it was. So this full network has been slowly being upgraded year by year, and it's classified data. But over the last 10 years, what has this network seen? because the last 10 years of data is now declassified. It's not released publicly yet, but it's declassified at least. And, you know, it was designed to look for nuclear weapons tests. How many has it seen in the last 10 years, above-ground nuclear weapons tests? None. It has never seen, what it's designed for, it has never seen. What does it see instead? Asteroid impacts, it turns out, because they're actually quite common. So what I'm going to show you is a list of 26 asteroid impacts in the last decade or so. And these are asteroid impacts that are larger than 1 kiloton of TNT, okay? So 1,000 tons of TNT, which would basically take out, you know, the financial district, okay? For scale, the bomb dropped over Hiroshima was 15 kilotons, okay? So I've grouped these asteroid impacts in the last decade into sort of three groups, sort of less than 10, between 10 and 20, which is roughly a Hiroshima-sized bomb, and much larger than 20, which is, so in other words, much larger than the bomb dropped over Hiroshima. And it turns out that there are 8 impacts in just the last decade or so that are roughly as large or larger than the bomb dropped over Hiroshima. Interesting, huh? So why haven't we had a city destroyed? And the answer is because most of the Earth is ocean, right? And if you look at this list, you'll see that most of these locations are out in the ocean, okay? So why has bad things not happened in the last decade? Luck, okay? So our current strategy for dealing with asteroid impacts is luck. Okay. I think that's unacceptable. So one of my favorite cartoons is a cartoon from Gary Larson's, which said, the real reasons dinosaurs became extinct, shows them all smoking. But I think the big picture here is that right now, things have changed, you know, because for the old saying is that, you know, the dinosaurs went extinct because they didn't have a space program. And what I'm going to tell you about today is that we may go extinct in spite of the fact that we have a space program. Although our space program actually is fully capable of defending this planet, it's not being done. And so what I'm going to tell you about is why we felt compelled. We had no choice but to take this task on ourselves. And we'll show you how that played out. So, two things. If at the end of today, and there will be a test, all I want you to remember is two things, okay? And the very first thing is what I'm going to show you right now. The second thing we'll get to at the end. But the very first thing that you should know is if you remember nothing else except for at the first half of the talk, it's this. We can stop asteroids from hitting Earth. We know how to do this, okay? So what does it take to stop an asteroid from hitting the Earth? Who here has seen Armageddon? Deep Impact, right? Okay, forget all that. The reason is because, you know, and it doesn't make a great movie necessarily, but if you have a lot of warning before something hits the Earth, not like a day or so, but decades, it's actually reasonably easy to keep something from hitting the Earth. Why? Because the Earth, you know, we're traveling around the sun. At this very moment, we're moving 65,000 miles an hour around the sun. We're a moving target, okay? Let's say there's an asteroid out there that's going to hit us in 10 years, okay? We're not going to be where we are right now. We're going to be someplace, you know, we've moved, right? So what that actually means is that asteroid has a date 10 years from now to be in the same place as the Earth is at that same time, right? So how do you keep an asteroid from hitting the Earth there? It's a matter of timing. It's like the old demolition derbies that you may have seen at the old state fair, right? Cars driving around two tracks. It's fine if they go through the intersection at different times, or some of the intersections out here on Market Street are kind of like that. But, you know, if you go through the intersection, another car goes through and the timing's different, it's actually not a problem, unless you get a ticket. But that's the key to getting an asteroid to miss the Earth. And, you only need to upset the timing by a little bit, and what that actually means is you need to change the speed of an asteroid by a tiny amount. If you have a decade or so of notice, the amount of speed that you need to change an asteroid's speed, and again, they're moving around the sun at about 65,000 miles an hour too, is about 1 millimeter per second. That's about the speed that an ant walks. Okay? So really, this whole problem boils down to, how do I change the speed of an asteroid that's out there in deep space, tens of millions of miles from Earth, by about the speed that an ant walks? Okay? Now, if you took any freshman year physics, you know that if you run into something with something else, you change its speed. Right? So we actually did this. In 2005, we flew a mission called Deep Impact. And what we did was we actually crashed a spacecraft into it. And this is a view from the camera of Deep Impact headed towards something called Comet Tempel 1. Whoa, here it goes. It just runs into it. Okay? It doesn't slow down. It's actually a rather amazing feat if you think about it. Here's the view of what it looks like from the spacecraft actually splits in two. And so watching that thing hit it, there's the explosion. What this thing did is it actually flew towards this comet, which is basically like a large asteroid, at a speed of about 20,000 miles an hour. Okay? And it hit it. So the technology involved here means that this thing, so 1 minute from impact, it's about 350 miles from hitting it. So here to LA. Okay? So it takes pretty good aim to hit something that's the size of a building from, you know, you're the distance of LA away and you've got 1 minute till impact. Okay? We can do that. So you should be aware that modern space technology can do some rather amazing things, including this. And it turns out that that's entirely sufficient if you were to hit an asteroid to keep it from hitting the Earth. And this was done in 2005, okay? So we actually know how to deflect asteroids. It turns out that's actually the easier part of the equation. The harder part of the equation is, where are you aiming this thing? If you don't know if an asteroid is on its way towards hitting us, what can you do? The answer is nothing, right? Because if you have your eyes closed, you know, the next one that's going to hit us is going to hit us, right? You have to know in advance of where these things are. Remember I said that you need a decade or so of notice in order to do this. And it turns out that's actually the big problem, right? From a technical level, is that we need to go find these things first, right? So you can only deflect asteroids that you can find, and here is the sort of disturbing thing. We know how many asteroids roughly are out there because we know how many hit the Earth. Remember, in the last, by counting asteroids that hit the Earth over the last decade, you have a good idea of the number of them as a function of their size. And by counting craters on the moon, you can get an independent means of doing that. And it turns out there's about 1 million asteroids that are circling our sun in orbits that could hit Earth that are large enough to destroy a major city. So the last one of these that hit was in 1908. We had a slightly smaller one on February 15th of last year, which exploded near the Russian city of Chelyabinsk. Very luckily, it came in at a grazing angle and exploded outside the city. But the shock wave still broke 100,000 windows in the city, so the people of Chelyabinsk were actually quite lucky that that wasn't closer. But of the 1 million asteroids that are out there, we know less than 10,000 of them. We've only found the locations of 10,000 of them. And it's not just their locations. You need to know where they're going to be. So you actually need to measure their velocity really, really, really accurately. Because remember I said that if you change the speed of something by 1 millimeter per second, that's the difference between a hit and a miss. So reverse that in your brain and say, how accurately do I need to measure its speed to know if it's going to hit or not? I need to measure it accurate to within 1 millimeter per second, and we can actually do that. Think about that for a second. These are objects, you know, smaller than this building. In fact, the asteroid in 1908 that destroyed an area roughly the size of the Bay Area was way smaller than this building. Almost charcoal black. How do you spot it 10 million miles from here and measure its speed accurate to that amount? Turns out we can actually do that. So now let's go back again to the disconcerting part. Roughly less than 1% of these asteroids are actually tracked today. So the other 99%, what can we do about it? If one of them is on an impact course, there's nothing we can do. We don't even know it, right? So, you know, the likeliest warning time we are to get right now of the next major asteroid impact is zero. Just like the asteroid on February 15th, which arrived. And the first warning to NASA was on Twitter. It's actually true. So, how many asteroids is NASA, which is doing more than all other space agencies combined on this problem, finding per year? About 1,000. So about 0.1% of the asteroids that threaten Earth. So at that rate, it would take us 1,000 years to find and track all these asteroids, by which time all these orbits have changed. In other words, you can never get there from here doing what we're doing right now. So when I said before that, you know, we may go extinct because in spite of the fact that we have a space program, that's what I mean. And you can argue all you like about the reasons NASA's funding priorities are as they are. And, you know, I was part of NASA for many years. And it's complicated to say why anything is in Washington, D.C. nowadays. But the fact of the matter is, and it's incontrovertible, we're not finding these things at a rate that's meaningful. And that's the situation that we're left with. So, about 2 years ago, I was at Google giving a talk, a fun talk. We called them tech talks. And I was telling this sort of fact that we actually, you know, the amazing thing is that we know how to deflect asteroids, okay? And yet more amazing, we were not looking for them. And so, you know, here we are. And I was sort of lamenting that fact that, you know, no one's solving the problem, right? But, you know, what is, you know, going back to the question of, you know, what do Americans do when there's a problem that needs to be solved? Somebody usually steps up and does it, right? And what happened was interesting at the end of that talk. This guy comes up to me and he says to me, "So, how would you find all these asteroids? Is there a way to do that?" And I said, "Well, yes, as it turns out, because the National Academies of Sciences had actually done a whole big study on this, and it turns out that because asteroids are almost charcoal black and they're therefore very difficult to spot from telescopes on the ground, they also absorb a lot of sunlight. They get warm, and they glow in infrared. Okay, so it turns out that if you had an infrared telescope, which is something like night vision goggles, essentially, a very large set, which you could place out in space, you could actually find and track these things. Okay, and so this would basically require the construction of a large, extremely accurate space infrared telescope to be placed in orbit around the sun. And he said to me, he goes, "Oh, well, how much would that cost?" I go, "Well, NASA priced it out at roughly $1 billion to do a project like that. But, of course, they have nothing. They have zero allocated towards it, so it's not getting done. But, you know, that's what it would cost." And he goes, "Well, how much would it cost to do that in the private sector?" I go, "Well, actually, quite a bit cheaper. As, you know, as speaking from experience as being part of the problem at NASA, I understood that federal procurement, anybody here ever have any experience with federal procurement? It's a wonderful thing, isn't it? It's there to all these rules are there for a good reason. They're there to prevent dishonest things from happening, but the cost of all that is incredible inefficiency." And I said, "Well, you know, maybe a third of that. I'll bet you could do that if you hired the right people." One of the lessons I learned at Google is that you can often do more with a small team of the very best people in the world than you can do with a team that's 10 times that size of people who are only excellent. And I said, "Maybe, you know, a few hundred million would be my guess." And he goes, "Oh, well, why don't you just do it?" And I thought, you know, me and what army, right? And he goes, "Oh, no, no." He goes, "I just donated to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, which is, you know, just down the street here. And he goes, you know, we're raising $450 million to build the new addition on the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. It's a wonderful museum, and it is. And he goes, and the people of San Francisco are coming together to do that. And nobody has any doubt we're going to be successful. In fact, he goes, any given time in the United States, there's hundreds of projects, you know, of order the size of a performing arts center or a museum or something like that. There's a few of them right here in San Francisco that are that were going on at the time. He said, so you're telling me that if the people of San Francisco can raise, you know, $450 million to build the wing of an art museum, you can't raise less than that to save the world. And that's how we got started. You know, this idea that, you know, there's a problem out there and that there's two things you could do. You could either, as I was doing personally at that talk, saying, well, isn't it just a terrible thing that nobody's doing anything about this? Or you can just go solve the problem. So it turns out that I was actually sort of remarkably well-placed because of my background and the people I knew to do something about this. After having, you know, a long career at NASA, I knew the people at Ball Aerospace who had done that mission which had deflected that asteroid or had deflected that comet. And it turns out the leader of that was a guy named Harold Reitzema. And he had actually been the person who had primarily responsible for coming up with the concept of the infrared space telescope for finding asteroids. Wasn't funded still, but he'd come up with that concept. And I called him up. I said, Harold, if we were to be able to do this in the private sector, how would you like to be involved in a project like that? And he said, sign me up. So then I knew there's a guy named Scott Hubbard who used to run NASA's Mars program. Sort of universally known as one of the greatest spacecraft engineers on planet Earth. And he ran NASA Ames, and now he was a Stanford professor, an old friend. And I called him up. We had lunch down at the California Cafe right down in Stanford Mall. And I said, Scott, here's what we're thinking of doing. We're thinking of raising the money privately and running a mission in the private sector. You're going to go, and how would you do that if you were to get a chance to do this? And he goes, well, you know, I would do it, you know, I would pick a company that could do this that had built Kepler, which was Ball Aerospace, as it turned out, and under Harold. And he said, well, and I'd put them on a fixed price contract because, you know, if you know exactly what it is you want to build, then you can do that. You don't need to do a sort of federal procurement on that. He goes, and I'd hire the 10 best people in the world and get them all on the project, not have any more than that. And he goes, okay, well, if we're doing that, you want in? And he goes, sign me up. So he agreed right there at lunch. And we said, well, me, Harold, and him, I said, well, who else do we need? You know, if we're going to get the 10 sort of best people in the world, we all said, well, we all looked at each other and said, Tom Gavin. Now, he had run the mission programs out of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. So all of NASA's planetary missions for the last roughly 40 years, he's been involved in all of them. And it turns out Tom was retiring from NASA. So we flew on down to talk to Tom and went into his office and said, hey, Tom, in a perfect world, how would you like to run a big space mission? And he basically went down the same line as both Harold and Scott, said, well, I would like to hire, you know, handpick my team. If I know ahead who the contractor is, I would sign them up. We'll not go through this proposal process. And we said to him, that's what we're doing on this mission. And he goes, sign me up. So we then each wrote down who we thought were the sort of 8 to 10 best people in the world that we needed. And our lists all matched to within about 2 people. And we hired them all. And this is how we got started. So then the next stop I had to make was over to the California Academy of Sciences, which had raised roughly $500 million to build this brand new and absolutely beautiful museum, which my kids absolutely love. And the chairman at the time was a guy named Dick Bingham, who is a friend. And I sat down with Dick and said, hey, Dick, if we were going to try and raise this money philanthropically, you know, what do we need to do? He said, the very first thing you need to have is overwhelming technical superiority. He goes, you want no question that the team you have can build this and be successful. And I said, well, I think we're partway there. And he goes, get that buttoned up. So we went back to Ball Aerospace and said, hey, If you guys have built the Kepler Space Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescope, two of the most successful space telescopes ever, and he said, would you be interested in building this telescope, which is now called Sentinel, but this infrared space telescope to find these asteroids, and would you be interested in running that? And they said, absolutely, because they see the handwriting on the wall regarding the future of federal budgets for science. And we had our team at that point. And Dick said, yes, it's possible to raise this amount of money philanthropically. It'll be 10 times as hard as you think, but you'll get there. And that started the saga 2 years ago. So we've been at it since then, and we've been going about it as a nonprofit, just as these museums have. And it's been quite a ride. We've raised enough money to go through the early parts of the project. We are still 5 years from launch, so we have a long ways to go. But we are building things. And we are doing the major design work, which on a spacecraft is 80% of the work. And we're about 15 to 20% through the whole project right now. So, again, we launched in 2005. So what are we building? This is it. It is a space telescope. It is about the size of a FedEx moving truck. So it's about, about the size of this room in height. It will launch from Earth and fly inwards in the solar system to orbit the sun, and it is incredibly sensitive. Sentinel can spot a charcoal briquette at 10 times the distance from Los Angeles to New York against the black sky. And that will allow it to spot asteroids, which are also black. And it will track them accurately enough so that we'll know the positions of each and every one of these things out to about the next 100 years. Accurate enough so that if any of those things is going to hit the Earth, not only are you going to know when, but exactly where, accurate to within a few kilometers. And we'll know this decades in advance of which any of these things might hit the Earth. So here's the way it's going to play out. What if we find one? And I should say, though, in keeping with the fact that we're a nonprofit, we put this data out there for the scientists of the world to see. Okay? And we want, at that point, what happens? Well, if there's a warning, philosophically, I think governments are not that great at dealing with threats that are probabilistic, off in the future, when you don't know exactly when something's going to happen. And so on. The classic example is New Orleans and Katrina, right? They knew sooner or later they're going to get hit by a hurricane, but did they do anything about it? Did they fix the levees? Not really. Governments are not so good at that, those types of problems. Climate change is another issue like that. Governments are really, really good at dealing with well-defined threats where there's a time, date, and place in somebody's congressional district, right? And the fact of the matter is, when you give a warning that something is going to hit the Earth, it turns it into a problem like that. And now the cost of deflecting an asteroid might only be the cost of, building a small mission like Deep Impact, which was only a few hundred million dollars. So for scale, the new bike lane that's being proposed for the Bay Bridge, just for the eastern span of the bridge, the new span of the bridge, is $500 million. Okay, so for about half that, you can save the Earth, right? So this puts us into sort of an interesting category, right? This is the class of problems. This is, to me, the only sort of global natural disaster that we know exactly how to prevent. And it is a global natural disaster that we must eventually solve, or else we become dinosaurs. I can't tell you when, and that's the whole purpose of this, is to tell us when, so that we can turn it into a defined problem that we can deal with. And that's really what we're doing. So, let me tell you what we are going to do. We are going to find and track all these asteroids going around the sun, and we are going to make, if you'd like, a three-dimensional moving map of all of these things. It's going to look something like this. It is going to have, this is a current map of all the known asteroids currently today. Okay? Looks like a lot of them. The sort of central part of it is the Earth rotating around the sun with the other planets, and there's an asteroid belt out in the outside. Those are not the ones we care about because those will never hit the Earth because they're between Mars and Jupiter. The other 10,000 are the roughly 10,000 we know currently today. Okay, and what Sentinel is going to do is to increase this map by a factor of 100. Okay, we'll find 100 times more than this, and we are going to make this dynamic three-dimensional moving map of the solar system. That will be the output of Sentinel. And using this dynamic map, you will be able to know when, where, and which asteroid is going to hit the Earth, or which ones will, and where they are at any given point so that we can send something out. This is what it's going to look like. So when Sentinel is done, we will have this incredible three-dimensional dynamic map that shows us the big picture. And I think that's going to be that is going to change humanity and life on this planet from the state as it was for the last 4 billion years, where it has been subject to the vagaries, if you'd like, of orbital mechanics and the random impacts that have continually shaped life on this planet, to the new age when that's no longer true. And I'm good with that. So I just want to put this a little bit in a historical context. You know, throughout the last several thousands of years, humans have looked up at the skies, and we've created astronomical catalogs and ways of predicting astronomical events off in the future. From the Mayans, who had the Mayan Codex, also known as the Dresden Codex, which predicted the phases and location of the planet Venus. It's also used for planting seasons. To the Arabic world, in which they built instruments called astrolabes, using their catalogs of the stars in the sky, which are all named, mostly have Arabic names, the guide stars. We learned on the space shuttle have Arabic names. And they built these instruments to predict where the locations of the planets were. To more recent times, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is a survey of the large-scale structure of the universe. This was funded by the Sloan Foundation. And what they did was they measured the locations of the galaxies out there and their positions and created the map that helped us understand how the universe is evolving. Okay? And the next, I think, great catalog, the next great codex, will be the Sentinel Codex, which in some ways, you know, it sort of traces its lineage back, you know, to the Mayans and the ancient Chinese and the ancient Arabic world. Those things were very useful too, because they provided practical advice on things like planting crops, to Sentinel, which will provide practical advice on how to protect the planet. So where we are is we are launching from Cape Canaveral in 2018. We are going to use a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket being produced down in Los Angeles by a company called SpaceX and Elon Musk. We are actually affiliated at some level with NASA, and that NASA is actually a junior partner in this endeavor of ours, because NASA has a network of ground stations all around the world which are used to pick up signals from satellites so that we can send probes to Mars or Jupiter or Venus and so on. And we'll send our data back through their network. And in exchange, we put it all online. So that's the current federal government role in this. They're not giving us any money, but they're letting us use their antennas. It's a great deal. So, so what does this all mean? I love this picture. It is a photograph taken from a Japanese mission orbiting the moon, and you can see the craters in the foreground, and the Earth. This is it's an Earthrise picture. It's kind of the analog to what I used to like to take of the moonrise pictures from the space station. And one of my favorite quotes from Carl Sagan, when you look at the pale blue dot, he calls it, is that you know, you and everyone you've ever known, you know, every general, every artist, every scientist, you know, lived out their lives on that or near that blue dot. A couple of lucky Son of a Gun's got to go to the moon. But other than that, you know, everyone lived there on that blue dot. And he said, like it or not, Earth is where we make our stand. Right? And that's the big picture. That's in the end, I think, what's important. You know, it's the survival of the human race. And we do have to solve this problem. You know, is it likely to happen tomorrow? Not likely that there will be a major impact tomorrow, but you don't know. And let's not go the way of the dinosaurs because we didn't bother looking, right? So Earth is where we make our stand. You know, my cohort in all this is a guy named Rusty Schweikart, who was the first man to fly the lunar module, one of those lucky son of a guns. And he likes to say that on spaceship Earth, we are not passengers, we're the crew. And that's the way I like to think of ourselves. And comes back to why we call ourselves the B612 Foundation. Anybody here ever read the novel The Little Prince? In that novel, the little prince lived on a planet, or an asteroid called B612. And the whole theme of that book revolves around the fact that what is essential is invisible to the eye. The most important thing may not actually be what's right in front of your face. It may not be the current scandal in Washington. It may not be the latest Hollywood blockbuster. It may not be, you know, paying the water bill, right? And it may be something that's invisible to you right now, but that doesn't make it any less important. In fact, it may be more important. And that's why we called ourselves the B612 Foundation. And I think it's really true. And so I just wanted to remember, I said before there was two things that I wanted you to come away with. The first one, anybody remembered it? Well, it's that we can deflect asteroids from hitting this planet. And the second thing is that we've turned this problem into one where the people who are going to make it happen are you all. It's the citizenry that's going to make this happen. It isn't happening in the government right now. And again, you know, I'm not bashing the government. Those issues are what they are. And you can complain about it all day or you can do something about it. And the thing that is going to solve this problem, you know, the thing that is going to really carry us forward is when people step up and do this. And we'll build our own art museum, if you'd like, by saving the planet. So thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Ed Liu, former NASA astronaut and CEO of the B612 Foundation, whose mission is to build, launch, and operate a deep space telescope to detect asteroids that may be a threat to Earth. I'm Brian Hackney, reporter for CBS5 in San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's audience question period. And Dr. Liu, we do have a number of questions, so we're going to begin. We don't have a lot of time, so we'll get right to the first from our audience, from one of the audience members. Of the 10,000 asteroids that we know about, do any of them have our name on it?
Of these 10,000, no. But there are some that we can't quite rule out yet that are coming close, and our data is just not quite good enough yet to say yes or no, but none of them has a high chance. There have been two asteroids that we have spotted before they hit the Earth, and the second one, first one was in 2008. The second one happened about 3 weeks ago. On January 1st, an asteroid was seen, a very small one, only 3 meters across, so size of a car. And the data wasn't looked at right away. By later that night, when it was looked at, it was realized that, oh my God, this thing is hitting right about now. good thing it wasn't a larger one. It turns out it hit in the South Atlantic, off the coast of South America. Had an energy of about 500 tons of TNT, so not large, but in the middle of no place.
Well, California was not the middle of no place in April 2012 when I noticed on your list you said that one actually, quote-unquote, hit. Do you mean that it exploded in the upper atmosphere or it actually hit?
Yeah, it actually exploded in the upper atmosphere. The smaller ones tend to explode in the atmosphere, which, again, doesn't make them not dangerous because it's shock waves that cause destruction. Now, I actually heard that one. Do you remember the one that fell over Marin? Mm-hmm. big flash in the sky, sonic boom, actually. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing it. We thought our kids had, like, gotten up and were doing something upstairs, so we went upstairs to tell them to go to bed. But they were fast asleep, and it turns out that that was the sonic boom we had heard from that very tiny one, and it was very small. It just caused basically a light show.
The Chelyabinsk, am I pronouncing it?
Chelyabinsk?
Yeah. Meteor from last year asteroid that exploded
over
Russia.
Would fit inside this room, by the way, that asteroid.
Would your system have seen that one coming?
Everything's statistical, and in order to see, it has the capability to see it, but in order to spot all these asteroids, you have to be out there long enough so that it comes close enough that you spot it. Now, the distance is quite large that you can spot it, so it isn't a simple yes or no, because it is capable of seeing it, but it has to come close enough within a certain period of time. So over roughly a 6 to 10 year period, it will find hundreds of thousands of these type of asteroids. It will not be all of them yet. So complicated answer to a complicated question.
Okay, well, let's talk about the bigger ones then. Yes. 63 million years ago, give or take a few mm-hmm. years, the dinosaurs get wiped out by the Yucatan impact crater. That's 63 million years ago. How big an asteroid and how often does such an asteroid hit Earth that would really have significant impacts on our climate and on our society? How often do those hit?
Those happen about once every 500,000 to a million years. Okay, it doesn't have to be big enough to wipe out all species like that. But generally accepted that something about a half mile across would be the end of human civilization. And the reason for that is because something that size is large enough to end growing seasons worldwide for a couple of years. And the Earth has only about a 2 to 3 month supply of food at any given time. So if you cut off all growing seasons worldwide for 2 to 3 years, it's pretty hard to see how civilization exists in its current form. Not that you wouldn't have some stragglers living after that. But so let's put this into perspective. Let's call it once in a million years. So in your lifetime, that means there's about a 0.01% chance that that's going to happen. Okay? 0.01%. It's not that small. Do you wear a seatbelt in your car? Because that's about the chance that you're going to die in a car accident in your lifetime.
So, okay, well then, just to sum up.
We're all riding in the same car.
This is a low risk. It's a low risk, high consequence
exactly.
event that you're looking at. How low, you're saying the lowness of the risk is 0.01%?
But for the end of human civilization.
Okay.
This is something really bad, right? And, what's it worth to not have that happen, right? If one person dies, every day, tens of thousands of people die from old age, right? And civilization goes on, and that's fine, right? That's just life. But if everyone dies at once, that's the end of everything that we as humans have built up. Our cities, our culture, our science, our art, our music, it's gone. Right? How can we risk this?
And your system, when it's deployed, will be able to detect something that if it hit, on let's say the lower end, if it hit, what are the effects of such a low end of
we're,
the scale asteroid?
We're basically looking for those that can destroy a city or more.
I see.
Okay. Now, again, NASA's found the very largest of these things by finding those that would be sort of civilization ending, wipe out the planet, and none of those are going to hit in the next 100 years. But below that, pretty empty out there, and in terms of what's known, and that's what we want to change.
Okay. And just to clarify, Let's say that we detect something coming in, and we go, boy, this is going to be close. The suggestion is that you're just going to go out and give it a nudge. Specifically, how?
By running a small spacecraft into it, just as we did
in
2005.
That,
or if you need to hit it multiple times just because you want to be really sure, go right ahead. I think that's a great idea.
Okay. When you sit down to fundraise for this, and you're making a pitch to collect money for it, how do you do your pitch?
Well, I think we're looking for folks who A, that are in some sense a bit visionary, because they can sort of say, they can sit back and they've done well enough in their lives that they have the luxury of being able to consider problems that are out there on sort of the decade or 100-year time scale, right? There is a large fraction of our population that lives day to day, and that those aren't donors to anything, right? They need to do what they need to do, right? But there is a fraction of our population that has the luxury, because they've done well enough, to look out at these other problems. And those are the people who support the art museums, the performing arts centers, and so on. And some of them are supporting CENTO.
Okay. Are you fully funded at this point to do this in 2018?
No, we are funded as far as it's keeping up with expenses. Let's put it that way. So as we build, we fund.
Okay.
Or as we fund, we build. They go together, right? So yeah. We have roughly another 10 years of both building, operating, and fundraising to go.
One of our audience members is curious about if we're getting any cooperation from China's resurgent space program, even as ours seems to be somewhat moldering. Is there cooperation from the Chinese?
Not from the Chinese specifically, but the United Nations just recently passed a resolution, just went through the General Assembly. This is a result of years of work by ourselves and others, actually, where because of the fact that once you find something that's going to hit the Earth, there is a decision-making process. Who pays? Who does the mission? You know, what if it's not going to hit? What if it's going to hit some country in the middle of Africa? You know, which may not have a space program. You know, who's responsible? There's a lot of questions there that the United Nations felt compelled to sort of set up the framework so that these decisions can be made, so that you don't spend, you know, the first 3 years arguing about the shape of the table kind of thing. So, what the United Nations actually did was organize the setting up of an international asteroid warning network, which, should somebody give them the data, will be able to allow scientists from around the world to all look at this objectively and say, how well do we understand this? How well is it known? And so on. But in sort of typical United Nations fashion, it came with no funding. And it started with, we hope somebody gives us the data, okay? And, you know, this is kind of what the U.S. government policy is on this. We hope somebody gives us the data, right? So it turns out that after Chelyabinsk, a number of folks were called up to Congress, including myself, to testify on, hey, how did this happen, right? The equivalent to 30 Hiroshima bombs exploded near a city. How did this happen, right? They called up the head of Space Command, the head of NASA, and the president's science advisor, John Holdren. And they asked them, well, did you see this coming? How did, you know, what happened? The head of Space Command said, not my problem. I look down for other things. I don't look up. I look down. The head of NASA said, well, the B612 Foundation is going to find these for us, essentially. And John Holdren, the president's science advisor, said, yeah, what he said, the B612 Foundation is on this. Okay? And, that's the way things go. And so, you know, the pressure's on, right? Or no pressure, either way you look at it, right? A friend of mine actually got a fortune cookie that said, only you can save the world, no pressure. And he sent that to me, so.
How much advance warning for something that's fairly small size, like the Chelyabinsk meteor asteroid? How much advance warning would we get?
We're looking to give decades of warning for
that much.
Yes.
For that size.
Yeah.
Wow. First, I have to do some business by saying you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Dr. Ed Liu, former NASA astronaut, who's discussing the threat to Earth from unseen asteroids and how we can detect them before it's too late. You're doing this privately. Are you kind of glad the government's not involved?
No, I don't want to say it that way. I don't like to say, you know, again, I'm not a government basher. I was a proud civil servant at NASA for many years, and the government does great things. Okay, but truthfully, in this matter, we're taking the lead. And you know what? If NASA was doing this, I wouldn't be doing this. There's plenty of other things I could be doing with my life. Right. If somebody else was doing this job, then I could Lord knows I could work a lot less for a lot more money, as my wife reminds me. But I didn't feel I had a choice in this matter because it's so important.
NASA did have a program, I think, the Near Earth Asteroid Detection Program. I think it was Tom Garrels who was in charge of that program.
A number of different people have played various roles in this.
What happened to NASA?
And it does subsist on a subsistence budget, which allows them to find 1,000 asteroids per year.
But your suggestion is that's not nearly enough.
Yeah. In year one, when Sentinel goes up there, when the B612 Sentinel spacecraft goes out there, it will find 200,000 asteroids in just year one.
Wow. Okay, in going through the questions from the audience, I have to say there are a number of audience members who are keen to know if you've seen the movie Gravity and if it really dovetails neatly with your own experience above the board the space shuttle.
I got to go see that movie because I keep getting asked that question and I haven't seen the movie yet.
I think you won't really relate to it. What do you see for the, you know, in space exploration in general? I mean, I grew up during the space race with great science reporters like Jules Bergman and Roy Neal. And
yeah, legends, these guys.
Man, that was motivating. The entire country was behind it. What do you think of our present level of interest in space science and space exploration and how NASA's doing?
Well, I'm hoping that we can play a role in this respect because think about what's going to happen here over the next several decades. Sentinel's likely to find something that's going to be worrisome enough that we're going to have to deflect it, okay? And the nations of the world will likely end up being, is my guess, an international program where we actually deflect an asteroid from hitting the Earth. It may not be large, may only be something that might only destroy a city, that sort of size scale thing. Not the kind of thing that, you know, we're saving the Earth, but literally we're going to deflect something that's going to, has the potential to cause great harm on Earth. I think that's a world-changing event, and I think that is going to generate a lot of interest, and I think that will be hopefully inspiring to kids to understand that science and math can do things like this. When I first became a brand new astronaut, you know, I was part of a group, what was called, we called them ASCANs, which are astronaut candidates. We came in our group 15. And one of the things they did was they brought in older astronauts. And one of the guys they brought in to just sort of tell us stories and give us some, you know, advice was a guy named Al Bean. Mm. He was the fourth man to walk on the moon and commander of Skylab. So he flew in Apollo 12. And Al came to it in his sort of Texas drawl and, you know, really disarmingly sharp guy because he has this sort of, you know, southern drawl, aw shucks mentality. And he said to us, he goes, you know, you guys are incredibly lucky. He goes, you've been given a gift. And we're all thinking to ourselves, yeah, we get to fly the space shuttle. And he's like, no. He goes, this is your gift. For the rest of your life, you can have the rapt attention of any school kid for 5 minutes. He goes, do with that what you will. And it is not because of who you are. Astronauts are interchangeable at some level. He goes, it's because what you are involved in. It's because you were part of something big. And I hope that Sentinel is part of that. I hope this gives inspiration to kids that we can do great things. So.
It is a project, though, that is apart from what NASA's doing right now.
Yes, it is not a NASA-run project, but again, we have NASA cooperation.
Have you, in the course of trying to gather interest in funding for this, learned something one of our audience members wants to know that would be useful in solving other large world problems like climate change? Could you go to climate change people and say, maybe you should try the approach we tried?
Well, I haven't yet made that sort of shift yet, and that's because for many of these other problems, and there are many, climate change, poverty, education, there's a whole host of issues that we face as a society. And in none of those cases do I know exactly how to solve them, especially for a finite amount of money. Okay? You know, in all of those cases, they involve changing the attitudes of perhaps billions of people, economies involving billions of people, trillions of dollars perhaps, no one really knows how to solve them yet. And that's really hard. Interestingly enough, changing the course of our solar system is much easier because it operates under the laws of physics. And very simple physics, actually. Celestial mechanics, the orbits of things, is something that we understand extremely well. I can't say that for economic systems. We don't understand those. And you can't manipulate them the way you can manipulate the orbit of something. And, you know, if there's one thing NASA and space scientists have done over the last 50 years, it is to understand how things orbit the sun so that I can send, or, you know, NASA can send a probe to Jupiter. And we can start the planning now, 15 years before this thing flies, and I can tell you to within a couple of meters of where Jupiter is going to be and where that thing is going to, it's going to enter orbit around Jupiter. And we're accurate to within a microsecond and a couple of meters. That we understand.
Let me ask you this. In terms of your own experience and getting people motivated, I do have to tell you that I think a lot of people feel that if we don't have a peopled space program, we used to say manned space program, that it doesn't really provide the kind of motivation we used to have. Nevertheless, when you landed in Kazakhstan, you had an interesting story to relate about how the Russians motivate their own kids.
Yeah, this was actually a Kazakhstani. We landed on my last flight was aboard a Russian Soyuz. Right after the crash of Columbia, I was sent as the first sort of two-man rescue crew to the space station. Spent 6 months up there with a Russian cosmonaut. We landed in our capsule after 6 months on the steps of Kazakhstan, godforsaken, middle of no place, right? And, you know, rescue helicopters, Russian military helicopters are landing around us, and these big Russian all-terrain vehicle carrying the rescue crew shows up out there. And driving behind it was a Lada. Anybody ever seen a Lada before? It's like half of a Yugo. And it's driving across, and there's no road out there, it's just driving across the plains, following these enormous, eight-wheeled military vehicles that are the rescue crew, and it's driving right behind it. Pulls up, and there's a guy with a gap-tooth guy who's a Kazakhstani farmer and his 8-year-old daughter. And they get out, and, we're literally just got out of the space capsule, and this guy comes up to me and with his little daughter, and he says to his daughter, "I want you to remember this day. These men returned to planet Earth from space." And he said, "And someday you could do that too. You know, you could take part in this." And he was really proud of her, you could tell. And she asked me for an autograph, which I signed for her. And I took my picture with this guy and his daughter. And I remember thinking how cool that was that she, he was literally just a subsistence farmer out there in the middle of no place. Judging by his car, and yet he wants his daughter to be able to see these great things, and that's why they saw the helicopters come overhead and the rescue vehicles, and they got in their car and they drove after it and followed them to the landing site.
So what you're suggesting is that if we had the Soyuz land in the middle of the San Francisco Bay Area, that we'd be motivated.
Perhaps, yeah, it'd be quite a tourist attraction if that happened.
It would. We've just got 2 minutes left, so it's time for to put our last question to you. From one of the members of the audience, do you have any fears that a catastrophic asteroid could hit Earth before you finish building the space telescope?
That's actually the urgency in building this thing, because we don't know when the next major impact is going to be. And if it happens while we're still building this, or if we have delays in constructing this, that's just dumb, right? I mean, I'll be frank about this. 50 years ago, if we were hit, or like we were 100 years ago in Tunguska by a large asteroid, that's bad luck, right? What could you have done, right? The dinosaurs, they had no space program. From this point forward, it's stupidity. Okay? And that's the urgency. Let's close off the gap here and let's just move forward on this. I think, I keep coming back to the fact that I want people to feel empowered. You know what? Let's just make this happen. And, the B612 Foundation and the Sentinel Space Telescope, is a step in us just taking control of our own destiny, and I think that's what we need to do.
Well, Dr. Liu, I have to say, in your précis of your own spectacular career, it lists three highlights, that now you're engaged in unveiling the secrets of the solar system, mapping the bottoms of the ocean, and saving the world with the B612 Foundation. I think I join with everybody here and in our radio audience in wishing you the best of luck, especially with the last.
Yeah, thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Ed Liu, former NASA astronaut and CEO of the B612 Foundation. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Brian Hackney. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.